Is President Trump right to block state AI laws? And should libertarians support federal AI regulation? We're going to answer those questions today. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. This is your libertarian review of news and culture from the editors of Reason Magazine. I'm your host, Peter Suderman, and today I am joined by my colleagues, Catherine Mengu Ward, Matt Welch, and returning special guest, Liz Wolf. Thank you so much for being on the show. So last week, Trump signed this executive order. It blocks states from regulating artificial intelligence. This is what AI companies wanted, but it's definitely going to be challenged in court. Catherine, how do you think about this and how do you square it with a kind of general libertarian desire for federalism?
I am enjoying, as always, the kooky scramble that Trump doing stuff causes these days. And so we have, on the one hand, it looks like Trump did this maybe mostly to, quote unquote, beat China. I don't know. He doesn't like when China wins, and it seems like China might be winning AI, question mark. So therefore, he signed this. On the other side...
Okay, didn't he also decide to sell them our super awesome AI chips basically, you know, at the same time?
Don't ask questions. Okay. So then second, what's happening is the people who want states to be able to regulate AI, a bunch of them want that because they think it will be bad for the big corporations. And of course, those are people on the left and the right who don't like big corporations for their own special reasons. I am kind of two minds. Frankly, like the American public, it seems. This is not the right way to do things. Executive orders, as we've talked about many times on this podcast, have constitutional and legal problems, as well as the problem of introducing political risks into every gosh darn thing. I like federalism as a general matter. And I don't really think Ron DeSantis and Gavin Newsom should be deciding AI policy for the nation, which is sort of how it would go if we let states do their thing, maybe. So there's your jumbled intro. Congratulations.
Matt, I want to read you a quote from Trump's AI czar, who is a podcast bro, David Sacks. He's got a podcast. A lot of people listen to it. And his defense here is that there are over 100 of them, that is state laws, have already passed. 25% are in California, New York, and Illinois. You got 50 states running in 50 different directions. It just doesn't make sense. We're creating a confusing patchwork of regulation. Okay, so I'm with him so far. Confusing patchwork of regulation led by California and New York generally doesn't sound good. But then he says, what we need is a single federal standard. Yeah, a single federal standard, right? Like, libertarians love those.
I mean, I'm sympathetic to his arguments and even semi-single standard argument for something that pretty easily crosses state lines and is kind of ethereal and it's in the tubes and stuff. That's technical terms.
For listeners who are not quite of the right age, the internet used to be a series of tubes officially, according to Congress.
You downhill can sense. We keep them in the tube. We'd be no problem. One huge difference between now and 1996, when the federal government got into federal almost one-stop kind of regulation of the internet, is that back then it was light touch regulation was the understood standard approach and everything. And Al Gore, who invented the internet, invented the tubes, he prevailed upon would-be regulating states at the time to say, can you just hold off? It's better to do this at the federal level and better to not do it with a heavy touch. We don't live in that world anymore. We live in a world where there's a left-right horseshoe converging on at least some tech regulation. There's a lot of people who want to repeal the aforementioned 1996 Telecommunications Act and especially the Section 230 protections right now. And so people are more and more apt to want to do the regulations. And so it makes sort of sense. What doesn't make sense to me is that you're doing this by executive order instead of legislation. The executive order does say we should have legislation. So I'm, I guess, grateful for small nods in the direction of actual government. But it also punishes people by withdrawing federal funds for broadband development that are totally unrelated. And this is a longstanding but recently increasing way for the federal government to try to do what it wants to by twisting the arm of state governments, which is absolutely anti-federalist and anti-sensical. If you want good government, pass a damn law. This ain't that.
They did talk about passing this as a law at one point, and then, as with many things in Congress and Washington, it simply didn't happen. Liz, how do you think about this in the context of the larger economy? So a lot of people have sort of argued, I think, with some evidence that AI is propping up the American economy right now. If you look at sort of what's working, it's artificial intelligence. It's all of these data center build outs. And if we didn't have that, we would maybe have anemic growth or no growth at all. And like, this is what is working for the American economy. On the other hand, a lot of stuff isn't working for the economy. And Donald Trump is out there talking about how kids don't need too many dolls for Christmas. So I guess what they need is unregulated data centers? I mean, why can't we?
The kids do need unregulated data centers, though. That's the thing. Okay. It's just there's a right and a wrong way to get them.
I like that Trump really follows like minimalist Montessori mom Twitter, like same as me. Like, we actually have so much in common.
Yeah, only sad beige toys for Baron.
No,
I had a friend who went to the toy fair within the last year, like where they exhibit all the brand new toys, and a huge number of them, like the big trend was AI toys. Basically, they're inventing Teddy Ruxpin, but for real. But like, why can't we have that approach to the rest of the economy?
You understand, first of all, that Zach Weissmuller's kids get entirely, they get 90% Waldorf toys, 10% AI and robot toys. You have to ask him about this.
This is the way. This is it. Ask us. Well, let's just talk about that for the rest of this podcast. I want to talk about how to buy your children AI Teddy Ruxpin and also little wooden trains. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm super sympathetic to this idea, right? I mean, in a sense, this AI is a huge gift to Trump, right? Because the impact that we would otherwise be feeling from tariffs has been avoided to some degree, in part, by companies basically engaging in really aggressive stockpiling, anticipating that tariffs were coming, but then also by the fact that, you know, things are awfully frothy and nice right now because of what's happening in the AI industry. But I actually think that, you know, Trump, it might be that he's playing this 4D chess game and is sort of anticipating that AI needs to be regulated as little as possible in order to sort of buffer the other effects of his economic decision making. But I actually think the really interesting thing about all of this is more political than econ oriented. I mean, we're seeing a lot of the Trump coalition sort of splitting at the seams. And it's like he wants to serve multiple constituencies, multiple masters all at once. And he sort of believes that he can just be the, you know, infinite handouts president with no consequences and with no bill ever coming due and with no coalition ever actually splintering and fracturing and getting pissed off at him. And I'm very skeptical as to whether or not that's actually going to work with the tech crowd. I mean, you see what he's doing with, for example, the NVIDIA chips and basically allowing them to be sold to China. And if you're a China hawk right now and you supported Trump, you're incredibly pissed off about this. If you're somebody who's really interested in American AI and semiconductor dominance, you're really pissed about this because you see this just as a means of enabling China to possibly win the AI arms race, which is sort of the number one issue that a lot of these people care about right now. So I sort of look at it as like a political liability, and Trump is attempting to sort of do multiple things at once, and it's not totally clear to me that it's going to pan out in his favor.
Matt, just on that note, I mean, is there a kind of element of, I don't quite want to call it corruption in the context of all the other things that Donald Trump is doing, but maybe a little bit of self-dealing here, and that Trump is close with a lot of people in the AI world, including David Sachs. There was a big piece that talked about how whenever AI stocks go up, whenever AI does well, you know, people in Trump's orbit like David Sachs end up with, it boosts their earning rate, right, sort of their wealth. Sort of turned out like the piece was maybe a little dicey, right? In some ways, kind of just like, well, yeah, they're so invested in like a bunch of stuff. Of course, when something does well, they're going to do well too. At the same time, doesn't Trump's approach to AI strike you as just a little bit self-dealing in some way?
I think it pales in comparison to the self-dealing in crypto, where he's literally saying like, if you invest in my shitcoin, you get to come to a party. At the White House. Like, that's just a little bit more blatant. I think that in the absence of other evidence that I'm sure will come out at some point, I think we have to take Trump at his word that he's been convinced by AI, that is the economic engine of the future, and he aims to win it. He's spoken about this a lot, during his first year of his second term. So I presume it's like that. And people will absolutely, we're talking about Trump here and the people around him, they are going to self-deal and enrich themselves. They do it every single day. You know, his at any given point, there's someone related to Donald Trump who stands to gain from opening up a new golf course or attaching themselves to a bid for Warner Brothers or whatever, doing some deal with Saudi Arabia. That just happens every day. That's baked into it, as far as I can tell. David Sachs is going to David Sachs no matter what. I'm just happy he's not in charge of Ukraine policy at this moment.
All right, let's talk a little bit more about dealing here, but not the AI kind, right? Because rumors are that Donald Trump also plans, maybe even as soon as today, by the time we are done this podcast with this podcast, plans to reclassify marijuana from a Schedule 1 drug, which is the same as heroin and LSD, to a Schedule 3 drug. This would have significant implications for the pot industry in terms of tax status, medical, what you can do with it medically, and banking access. So, Catherine, pot would still be regulated by the federal government, but less so. Do you think this is a good thing?
I do think it's a good thing. In general, I think it is good if we align in any way, shape, or form our laws with reality. And the fact is that there are obviously medical applications for cannabis. There, the previous scheduling of marijuana as a Schedule I drug was always pure scaremongering, and it also made doing research on the useful medical applications much harder. It made penalties more severe for a drug that did not actually represent the kind of harms that people fear from drugs that are typically classed as Schedule One. Anytime you change a law like this, you do wind up with second order effects that were not exactly as intended. And so this is going to have implications for people who have found their way in the confusing thicket of quasi decriminalization, quasi legalization, state level and not federal level. That's going to cause a reset for all of this. And there will be some risks to people who have gone into business in the marijuana space. But overall, I think it's a good thing. And because I am going to debate marijuana legalization at the TPUSA conference this week, I am delighted that Trump has made a move on marijuana with this particular timing, since it will make my job a little easier in that crowd. I think it's really important to go talk to people about this issue, especially about the drug war, people who are potentially convincible. I'm hoping that 25,000 young conservatives, a few of them in there, will be convincible and maybe a little more convincible thanks to the reclassification this week.
Good luck. Is this a debate where there's going to be a winner? Is there going to be a vote?
I don't think there is a vote. It will be a sort of semi-formal onstage debate at the conference.
Well, it sounds like you're going to win on policy if Donald Trump goes through with this. I think that one of the points you make is just worth underlining. People don't seem to understand that, yes, you can get pot gummies delivered to your door by UPS right now. But if you are a big pharmaceutical company, you kind of can't do research on drugs that use cannabis and then release them to the public. I mean, it's not literally completely impossible, but it's more or less impossible, right? Like the regulatory hoops you'd have to go through in order to make that happen basically make it functionally impossible to do so in a way that is legal, where you can get funding for it, where you can do banking, all of this. Liz, you were saying right before this podcast started that maybe you should just spend your whole pregnancy high because it might actually help you. Right? With the medical part of this? You want to talk about that a little bit?
It'll also help me a lot when I have to deal with CPS. So thank you, Peter.
Yeah, that was great. HIPAA violation right here on the pod.
No, it is super personal. I've, spent a decently long time here at Reason writing about, the reasons why weed, I think, is sort of wrongly pilloried. I mean, a few years back, I wrote, I got stoned and did my taxes, which also it was very helpful having like my husband guide me through this because he's like a responsible person who actually knows how to do taxes, unlike me. Like I was always going to be kind of a shit show doing my own taxes.
I feel like people who are sober are also shit shows doing their taxes, as evidenced by all those studies that show when you give the same complicated problem to two tax professionals, you get completely different answers. And then the IRS can't tell you which one is right.
That presupposes that tax professionals are not stoned, and I don't think we can.
fair enough.
I did a whole documentary for recent TV about New York's weed nightmare, and basically, you know, the absurdity and the sort of like about face where the city legalized or the state legalized it, a whole bunch of pot shops in the city opened, and then the regulators sort of came after them because there was never really any clear framework that was given to these pot shops and these sort of would-be business owners to make it clear what they actually had to do to operate legally. I mean, we put them into really bad situations time and time again. But yeah, I mean, I kind of love what Trump has to say about weed. Like, I actually think he's very much in touch with how normal people look at it, myself included. Incredible Trump quote from over the summer. We're looking at reclassifications. Some people like it. Some people hate it. Some people hate the whole concept of marijuana because it does bad for the children. It does bad for the people that are older than children. Like, in a sense, he's totally correct. Like, some people are really into it. Some people can't handle it. Bad for kids, right? Like, all of these things, he's hitting the right notes 100%. But I mean, look, pot is really, really, really popular. And for a lot of people, pot is really, really, really harmless. For some users, pot is going to be harmful. Some people just have issues with impulse control, and there's nothing that we can do or that regulators or the state can do to really change that. I mean, if you have a problem with it, you should be self-aware and have good people in your life to intervene and ensure that you don't take it too far. But this whole trope of like, it makes you, you know, as Frank Ocean sampled in a song, lazy, sluggish, stupid, and unconcerned. Yeah, sometimes if you don't use it correctly, just like any substance will. And I think it's actually important as we sort of navigate this weird zone where pot has been legalized in a bunch of places, but there's been a huge backlash and it's become very vogue and trendy to be like, well, there's no good social norms that govern people's pot usage. So actually, we should go back to waging the drug war. And it's like, no, it has delivered a ton of good to the, you know, people like me. It has done good things in my life, and it is incredible that I can use it and write about it and be a mom who's always getting baked on my rooftop when I'm not pregnant. And like, I can be public about I can be public about this and not have to fear the authorities coming and trying to put me in a big metal cage for a really long time when I'm a productive member of society, damn it. It's a good thing. We have made huge progress on this. And it's just very upsetting to me, this idea that some people want to wage the drug war more. And I think Trump is right on this.
Lazy, sluggish, stupid, and unconcerned. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
I listen to Frank Ocean, but I don't remember the lyrics. That does sound like a good way to do your taxes. All right, we're going to move on here. Before we do, I just want to thank everybody who came out to Reason Versus last week. We had a packed house for a debate about big tech. Sadly, we did not win, but Robbie Suave, Liz Nolan Brown made very strong arguments. And if you weren't able to attend the debate live, you can watch it on YouTube. Speaking of things you can watch on YouTube, let's go to an ad. Hey, Reason listeners. Do you want to help a student think clearly in the age of AI? Reliance College invites students aged 16 to 24 to the Great Connections Weekend Seminar, Reason and Power. It's going to be held from January 9th through 11th in 2026 at the Hilton Houston Plaza Medical Center. This immersive three-day experience builds the skills no algorithm can replace: clear reasoning, persuasive communication, and independent thought. Students explore great works by Ayn Rand, Epictetus, Machiavelli, and more. Sessions are held in small, dynamic groups. You can develop the habits of mind that drive real innovation. This is not a lecture. It is a conversation, and it changes how you think. Registration is just $99.99 with scholarships available. You can learn more and apply at reliancecollege.org/seminar. That's reliancecollege.org/seminar. All right. Some tragic news over the weekend that obviously we have to talk about here. There were multiple mass shootings, one in Australia that has claimed at least 15 lives, another one at Brown University here in the United States that resulted in two deaths. The Australian attack targeted a Jewish gathering at Bondi Beach. Authorities say it was an act of terrorism and that the two shooters, one of whom is deceased, the other one is in the hospital, have links to the Islamic State. Here in the U.S., authorities are still searching for the Brown shooter. There's a person of interest who was picked up but then released. So we've covered a lot of these horrible events over the years, and it's always just hard to even know what to say. But I just want to go around and get everyone's reaction to this pair of really ugly, really unpleasant, I mean, just horrible events in the news that you can't ignore, you can't turn away from. Catherine, let's start with you.
I guess the pairing is what's kind of on my mind, the two of these incidents together. And it seems to me to make the argument kind of all on its own for not leaping to public policy. And that's always hard for us here on this public policy oriented podcast and in the world. But these are two places with very, very different gun control laws, with very, very different political landscapes where similarly tragic things happened. And so, you know, I have this kind of inclination to not jump to policymaking. Of course, that serves my priors, as things always do. And so I put that asterisk on it. My other thought is I had a very Jewish weekend. I went to a bat mitzvah, which was incredible, delightful, beautiful. And of course, last night was the first night of Hanukkah. So I made latkes and we lit candles and we did all the things. And at the bat mitzvah, there was a kind of rehearsal of the Hanukkah story. And, you know, I am married into Judaism. I was not raised Jewish. So maybe this is something that Jews have already thought about. But you know, the story of Hanukkah is the Greeks are being jerks, the Maccabees push back, the temple is left with only one tiny jar of oil. They know they're not going to be able to get more for 8 nights. And we talk a lot about the miracle of the oil burning for 8 nights, but not maybe as much as we should about the courage of the Jews who light the candle, who light the oil that first night, knowing that there is not 8 nights of oil. And I think that there's something about those people on the beach, you know, they were out there doing their Hanukkah, despite the fact that it was a little risky, like they lit the oil. And I just find myself very moved by that.
And I would add that they came back out today.
Yep.
Australia has completely different time than we do. So it's a little bit confusing, but
it's already the second day of Hanukkah there, maybe the third day. We don't understand how time zones work.
But the pictures that and video I've seen from there have been really, really moving. People just came back out, including a lot of people who were there yesterday, like, we are going to do this here now. And people in New York, which is a very Jewish city, came out very strongly all over the place and said, no, we're going to come out here. We're going to dance. We're going to light candles. We're going to eat some latkes. We're going to keep going through this. So I appreciate that sense of defiance in the face of everything, and also just celebration. In the face of it's terrible. Bondi Beach, from what I understand, is a wonderful place. Our friend Josh Zepps is in Sydney, and just a lot of other people who are really, banged up on this, and understandably so. The Brown thing I'm worried about, besides the fact that it happened and that we still don't know who the killer is or where the killer is, from what I understand, at least as of this taping at 2 in the afternoon on the Monday. But I really just sincerely hope it's not political. That would make it even worse than what it already is. And given that one of the victims was a senior member of the College Republicans, it's worrisome. And it'll just add to all kinds of other bad pathologies that we've been marinating in for a while. And it's heartbreaking stuff. Very heartbreaking.
Liz, what about you?
My heart is definitely with all of the Jews who are harmed by this, and just people who felt like they'd already sort of been living in fear for a long time, fearing the rise in anti-Semitic, you know, hate crimes and incidents, and then feeling now like something awful has actually happened. It occurred to me that I know so many surfer Jews, Australian and American, and I was like, oh, dang, like this is actually, you know, the only way to get surfers out of their truly like zen-like bro-y trance state is, you know, dealing with issues like this. I mean, this is awful, and it's just kind of deeply violating that you can't hold religious ceremonies on the beach without having that sort of awful, awful hatred come your way. I also keep thinking about how we've seen a really interesting trend. I mean, Australia has had pretty intense gun laws for quite some time now. And, you know, quite a few years ago, I think 3 decades ago, roughly, they started doing their gun buyback program when they were basically trying to implement really strict gun control. But it actually, all of this inspired me to look up and see, you know, what has Australian gun ownership looked like in the last few years? There's actually been a little bit of an interesting rise in gun ownership since the COVID era. And so I'm kind of curious about whether or not we'll see some of these things sort of percolate in our discourse a little bit more, and especially in Australian discourse a little bit more. I mean, the guns that were used in this attack were legally owned, which, you know, should probably complicate the narratives of the many gun grabbers, but I'm not totally sure that it necessarily will. And Australia's historically a place that acts very quickly to impose gun control. And so I'm very curious about whether or not there will be a sort of backlash that will end up harming the people who have bought guns in recent years, in part because of how their government reacted during COVID. So I'm a little bit concerned about the political aftershocks of this.
Yeah. So, you know, Catherine said, expressed my sentiment when she said that she doesn't like to jump to policy, but policy jumps out of these events. I think often, unfortunately, I'll just read you a line from the New York Times as a news item. Mass shootings are rare in Australia because of the country's strict gun laws. Nation has one of the lowest gun-related death rates in the developed world. And this is one of the things that we hear all the time, is that the United States should respond to horrific events like this, you know, when we've had mass shootings, with a program like Australia's. And I think there are reasons to think that it wouldn't work even as well as it has well in Australia. But even if it worked exactly as well as it did in Australia, Australia managed to buy back about a third of the guns that were in circulation. And most of the guns that they bought back were sort of old family shotgun, kind of hunting type weapons. They weren't the kind of weapons that the people who are really worried about, say, assault rifles, which of course is a sort of fake category, but the kind of AR-15 style platform weapons that people get very concerned about. They didn't get a lot of those. They got sort of older weapons that you were not going to expect to see to be used in, you know, these types of events. And so even if you had, even if you successfully pulled a third of the guns in the United States out of circulation, there are 300 to 400 million guns in America. You would still be left with hundreds of millions of guns in circulation, and most of the AR-15, these kind of platform style weapons that get labeled as assault rifles would not be part of that. Again, if it worked exactly as it did in Australia. And so Australia's gun rules are just not a model for the United States. They are not going to work to, they're not going to solve the problem you are trying to solve here. And so I just think that even people who are, you know, sort of supportive of what is happening there should look into what is actually going on in Australia, look into what actually happened with those laws, and try to think about how that would apply here. All right, so we do need to move on here to another topic. Last week, the Trump administration seized an oil tanker off the coast of Venezuela. It's an escalation in what's going on there. Trump also implied that land strikes would be starting too. Matt, there's almost no public case being made for any of this. Like, we are just walking right into a war, and there's no explanation. It's just because I help me understand, like, what even the reasoning is here. Like, give me the steel man. I don't know. There's probably not a steel man case. There's not a good justification for this. What is the justification at all? The bad one. I haven't even heard that.
Let me give the best one then, and not make jokes about how much Peter Suderman really loves to see 15-year-olds die of fentanyl. So Venezuela is a terrible country run by a horrible authoritarian. And that terrible country run by a horrible authoritarian has not just impoverished their own people, but acted in such a way that more than 7 million people have fled, largely in the direction of the United States, helping a refugee crisis on the streets of many American cities, which disrupted our politics and civic life as well writ large. How do you deal with this crisis? Well, if you are now asserting the Trump corollary of the Monroe Doctrine, which the Trump administration is on record officially doing, you apply as much pressure as humanly possible and legally possible, let's say, even if it's against the law, to give the Maduro regime the impression that you are going to invade if he doesn't leave. And meanwhile, you hold high-level negotiations with him, back channel or whatever, to say, hey, dude, you really should leave. And those conversations have been ongoing for the past several weeks. The administration has clearly been trying to do regime change for the past few months. They just think that they can do it on the cheap, that you can do it by pressure because we have the world's largest military in history. It's in our backyard. Could blow up just a few boats. Haven't killed any Americans really so far. And yeah, there'll be some outrage from people who don't understand the joy of doing frog memes on Twitter. But maybe we can get that to happen. And if you get that to happen, then that's going to also choke off the Cuban regime, or at least like one of its kind of key things to help prop it up. And so then maybe that does a domino theory, reverse domino theory, where the last of the leftoid Caribbean regimes then get toppled and Marco Rubio is declared king of the Gulf of America.
Okay.
I have an earnest question for Welch, though. Is it like regime change on the cheap, but with more diplomacy and fewer deaths, like a definitely good thing compared to all of the alternatives that exist
yes.
out here?
Yes and no. No, in that it's cheaper, but the flaw is in the regime change. The United States, in my estimation, should not be in the business of regime change, and that when it is, even sometimes when you get a good regime change, in some cases, or at least you get a good regime, that there are unintended consequences and it tends to go pear-shaped. I don't think that is the way that we should. We have the world's biggest thumbs. So should we thumb the scale in the direction of the good guys versus the bad guys in various places? Certainly the Venezuelan opposition, for whom I have an immense amount of respect, admiration for, they're like, please, you know, they've given up on the ability to do it themselves, even though they're still fighting, many of them inside the country. And so, of course, they're like, get that thumb on that scale. Let's go. I just don't think that when the U.S. exercises that, when you do that, then the people who are the beneficiaries of that own much less of that victory. That is a big political cost. For contrast, the anti-authoritarian, anti-communist dissidents in Central Europe, for the most part, owned their own victories. We didn't thumb the scale. Yes, we were fighting a global Cold War, but it's not like we created, Charter 77 out of whole cloth, unlike, say, the Contras in Central America. So that meant that those revolutions, once they were won, had much more power. They couldn't be undermined. They couldn't be seen as being imposed from outside. This has been a 125-year track record of the United States of imposing regime change in the Caribbean, not having legitimacy among the people who are supposedly, and sometimes in some short term, are freed. So that is my problem with it. Yes, it's cheaper than going full boots on the ground, but it's going to create unintended consequences. We did regime change on the cheap in Libya, and that went absolutely pear-shaped. And those of us who were lonely on the outside saying that, even if it looks good right now, in the summer of 2011, we were vindicated later. And I'm afraid that we would be vindicated in this case too.
Catherine, so I exaggerated just a little bit when I said I'd heard no justification. I mean, it's true that the Trump administration is not out there making the case, but Donald Trump was asked last week what this is all about. And he responded, well, it's about a lot of things. But one of the things that it's about is that they've allowed millions of people to come into our country from their prisons, from gangs, from drug dealers, from mental institutions, probably proportionately more than anybody else, basically making an immigration case for whatever it is he's doing with these drug boats and seizing this ship and maybe doing some regime change. Does that make any sense at all to you?
I mean, we've had the immigration case. We've also had the war on drugs case, right? The original justification for the first bombing of the boat was they're bringing drugs to the United States. And that was a sort of pretty straightforwardly made claim. I think there's a lot to quibble with around all that. In fact, more than quibble with, I think it is flatly wrong. But I also just can't believe I am old enough to once again be hearing, are we doing regime change for a cover for the war to get the oil? Like, I'm old enough to remember, as the kids say, when that was the whole kerfuffle around the Iraq War. And the words oil tanker, like, just sent a chill up my spine, like, oh, God, we're doing it again. And, it, you know, this is the first time that argument has been floated. It is an, you know, there's oil rich country and natural resources are always going to be the subject of human political disputes. But
and if I can interrupt on just that point, Trump has said several times that America was in the wrong for not seizing the oil in Iraq.
Right.
He's like, hey, there's oil there. What the hell?
Right. Which, like, once again, is the, well, is he just saying the quiet part loud, or is he saying the thing that sort of controversialists and conspiracists wanted to believe? I don't know. And of course, I am on the record many times on this podcast as saying I was on the side of regime change very early in the Iraq War. I said, you know, actually, it seems like maybe if we could quickly and cheaply do a favor to these millions and millions of people who are living under tyranny at very little cost to American life, and maybe also create a positive trend in the region, that would be good. So I'm very sympathetic to people who believe that this time about this thing. But I think we know how bad it went in Iraq. And I think Matt is right about how badly it would go if we try it again.
Yeah, take it from a former Weekly Standard staffer, folks. She knows from neocons. She knows from regime change wars. They don't work, she can tell you. But we are, in fact, doing it again, like Catherine said. And what we're doing again is going to a commercial break before we answer one of your questions. The Reason Roundtable is sponsored by CrowdHealth. So around this time every year, open enrollment season rolls around for health insurance. Health insurance companies hope you'll just renew your policy without looking at the price or the fine print, which can be pretty confusing. CrowdHealth, the healthcare funding alternative for people who want to make their own healthcare decisions, is a different way of doing things. CrowdHealth, it's a community of people funding each other's medical bills directly. There's no middleman, no networks, no nonsense. So I write a lot about health insurance, and I'll tell you, even I know it can be confusing, it can be frustrating, just a real pain to deal with. CrowdHealth is an alternative to health insurance. You can join for just $100 with access to low-cost prescriptions, lab testing tools, a database of quality doctors who've been vetted by CrowdHealth. Something major happens, you pay the first $500, and then CrowdHealth steps in to help out with funding the rest. This is not Obamacare with all its frustrations and high prices. It's a different way of thinking about funding medical expenses. CrowdHealth members have saved over $40 million in healthcare expenses because they refuse to overpay for healthcare. This open enrollment, take your power back. Join CrowdHealth to get started today for $99 for your first 3 months using code REASON at joincrowdhealth.com. That's joincrowdhealth.com, code REASON. CrowdHealth is not insurance. Opt out. Take your power back. This is how we win. Join crowdhealth.com. Okay, it is now time for our listener question. We answer one of these every week. We love to do so. And please remember, if you want us to answer your question, send your short, succinct, pithy, and not very long question to podcasts@reason.com. That is podcasts@reason.com. This week's listener question comes from Philip, and it is about socialism. He writes, I feel as if the support of socialism today may herald an optimistic future rather than doom, at least if modern political structures can continue to prevent the actual accomplishment of socialism. Pretty big if there. Socialists desire equality. They abhor power against the poor, and they often hold to principle. Yes, they prefer outcomes rather than opportunities, and they are focused more on equality rather than liberty. But isn't this something that could be righted with education? Why am I wrong? Liz Wolf, is Philip wrong?
Oh, sweet Philip. Yes, I think so. Nothing, no disrespect to our friend Philip here. But I do feel as though I am perhaps a touch more cynical on this front than he is, especially living in Zohran Mamdani's New York. I just feel like legitimately a lot of their stated goals are bad, like very, very, very bad, as well as the means that they sort of favor to getting to those goals. I mean, the goal is legitimately equality of outcome, not equality of opportunity. And I feel like we just sort of glaze over that fact. I mean, I feel a little bit like a New York City kulak. Like, don't take away my good things that I have worked hard for. I legitimately am part of the sort of striver class here, and I don't want all of those gains and that hard work to be sort of erased by the state in favor of, I don't know, redistribution to my fellow citizens. We already do a lot of that, and it enables an awful lot of corruption. And it also drives a lot of people out of this city and to live in different places. I'm very worried about, you know, what specifically Zohran Mamdani is going to do to this city. The things that he says will fix our city will, in fact, make it worse. And, you know, whether that's leaning further into the rent stabilization and rent control regime as a means of fixing our housing supply issues, when in reality, the thing that we know would actually fix this is, A, less regulation to do more building, B, just less shackling of developers in general to do more building, and C, scrapping the whole rent control and rent stabilization scheme, not freezing the rent and leaning further into using the levers of the state to try to, you know, fix the system and force landlords to cap rents at a certain amount. All of these things are just, you know, awful. We're basically making it so housing supply right now is not subject to market forces, which makes it so that people like me, about to welcome my second kid into this city, have a really hard time finding places that fit our needs, that fit our budgets, when really it shouldn't be that hard with like two earners and like an awful lot of flexibility in terms of which borough we live in. It really should not be this bad, and yet it is. And it's very frustrating to me that socialists, including many of my neighbors who voted for Zohran, can't see the relationship between cause and effect and can't see the relationship between you allow more state intervention into these marketplaces and it results in really bad outcomes for people. You know, the other thing that I'd point to, which I'm sure Welch will get to and have even more fire than I do, is like, we can't allow this type of toxic ideology into our public school systems. I mean, legitimately, one of Zohran Mamdani's priorities is trying to take away gifted and talented programs from children. And again, that's servicing this equality of outcome, not equality of opportunity agenda. I don't want that. That is not the goal of public education. The goal of public education is to meet kids where they're at and then attempt to raise them to the highest possible level that that child can be raised to, not to bring all of the kids smushed together and bring them down to the same level at ever younger ages to make it harder for there to be any outliers. That is so profoundly messed up.
I like how you were just like, here's what we should do. And you list a whole bunch of things. Like there's like at least four or five right, just like throughout there, but they're all just like not socialism. Let's just not do that.
You understand.
Matt Welch, you also pay taxes in the People's Republic of Zohran Mamdani. Stan?
You could tell that Liz is a young parent because she's like, we can't allow socialism in our public schools.
Yep. It's the astronaut gun meme of like, it was always
it
like
always that. Was. Yeah.
I got some news for you about what kindergarten's going to look like there. For
it's big real government step. Hands off my Medicare energy.
Matt, as if I'm not going to homeschool my heart out. Come on.
Oh, Jesus Christ. I would just say that the problem with Philip's question is that he puts socialism and optimism in the same sentence. Nope. Just nope. 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 There's never been an optimistic outcome when you put socialism in a thing. Just sorry. Hasn't been. I think there's been, if we all remember the underpants gnome meme from South Park about business, like step one, do something about underpants. I forget what. Make them. Step two is a question mark, and step three is profit. I feel like there's a ton of this wishful thinking slash cope in politics. Like, yeah, I know that socialism is bad, or like, you know, national conservatism is bad, or fill in the blank ism is bad. But maybe with the step two, with the question mark, the step three is going to be libertarianism. It's like, No, you didn't get libertarianism through Donald Trump. You didn't get it through Bernie Sanders in 2015 and 2016. Some libertarians of note were like, you know, Bernie, at least he's honest kind of thing. Like, nope. This is not going to lead to that thing. I think people are trying to talk themselves into what is obviously not a good thing, is going to lead to some libertarian future. And sorry, it's not.
I want to defend Philip. I feel like Philip's question is a good one. So I'm going to stick up for our question asker. You know, I interpret his question to be like, hey, you know, maybe a bunch of people trying to take a principled look at our current political mess. And they look at this like mushy, self-serving, you know, expediency driven, pragmatic mess, and they say like, actually, I think I would prefer some kind of political philosophy that has a comprehensive vision for how we could achieve a better world. And like, he's pretty clear in his question that he's like, that's not the better world I want to see. I disagree with them about the outcomes, but could it be heartening that people are trying to think and talk about another way of doing politics? And I do take some heart from that, in the same way that I very, very often prefer to debate or even like be at a bar with socialists as opposed to DC operators, DC kind of pragmatists.
As opposed to the people.
Those are the two options in my world, Liz. Yeah. Sorry to say. And
as opposed to the people who used to read the Weekly Standard.
And I think that that's because, you know, this is, you know, we're not going to agree, but at least we can kind of talk seriously and have shared values about the things that the terms of the debate. I wish I didn't live in a world where those are the only two options for people to drink with. I chose the world where those are the only two options, and I love it here. Thank you very much.
You sure did. I tend toward a Liz Wolf, Matt Welch sort of response to this answer practically. However, I will defend this idea because, in fact, something that we have seen repeatedly at Reason Magazine is that with the rise of Bernie Sanders, a lot of the Bernie Sanders fans were Ron Paul fans first. And so they went the wrong way on this trajectory, but it does suggest that there is this kind of a spectrum here that you where you can move back and forth. And when I wake up and I'm feeling optimistic and happy and like positive about the world, I think that those Bernie Sanders fans could come back to maybe not Ron Paul, who is wonderful, but probably not going to be a major force in American politics over the next 30 years. But I do wonder if like the next Ron Paul could pull those Bernie people back, and that the next Ron Paul, the next person who sort of sits on that spectrum, could end up moving some people who sort of think of themselves right now as socialists because it's anti-system, because they want something that is philosophically coherent, because they want something that seems honest and like actually straight with you rather than inside DC bullshit people. They want that, and that maybe some kind of libertarian inflected politics could give it to them if we had the right person. Speaking of the right person, I do want to talk about one more news story here. Jimmy Lai was the right person for Hong Kong. And unfortunately, he has been found guilty in a national security trial. So he was the publisher of the pro-democracy Hong Kong newspaper, Apple Daily. Matt, do you actually just want to tell us a little bit about Jimmy Lai and why he is important to us at Reason, to China and to Hong Kong, and also just to free speech and the cause of free speech all over the world?
Jimmy Lai is actually a British citizen who lived in Hong Kong, a serial entrepreneur, started getting the media business in the early 90s and founded Apple Daily. Don't think it has connections to Tim Apple. I think he started that in the early aughts, but I could have that wrong. You all have Wikipedia. You can do it. But Apple Daily.
I believe it was actually early 90s.
Early 90s, Apple Daily already? Yeah. So it became one of the largest and arguably the most influential of the anti-authoritarian, anti-Chinese newspaper, anti-Chinese government, red Chinese government newspapers in Hong Kong. Hong Kong goes back to China in 1997. It's supposed to be like, yeah, you know, that's the treaty, but we're going to respect, those are the international obligations running out, but we're going to respect Hong Kong kind of autonomy and their sort of free markets and rule of law ideas, which are different than those of red China. And China has been going back on that ever since. And that got supercharged in 2020 with the Hong Kong democracy protests. He was arrested, I think, for the first time really in earnest in 2020. Apple Daily was shut down and he's been rung up on a series of charges having to do with sedition. Like hundreds of articles would be found to be seditious. We are fortunate in this country still, although there's a lot of forces on the wrong side of this issue, in that we have a long-standing tradition against the notion of seditious libel, which was a break. This predates the American Revolution, by the way. Like, you could insult the crown, we decided here, even though you couldn't really do that, even in England. You can't insult the crown anymore in Hong Kong. He's the biggest living avatar of that. He's old. It's in the 70s, I do believe. In 2019, 2020, he was meeting with a lot of then Trump administration officials, Mike Pence, chief among them, but other people as well, who were outraged by this. I don't have a lot of expectation that the current administration will express the same amount of outrage about it, because the world just looks different. And I think we've all devolved a little bit about our commitments to international free speech, let alone free speech here in the United States. But it's awful. It is kind of the nail in the coffin about free speech in Hong Kong and the notion that red China wouldn't suppress it at every opportunity. So it is a very bad thing indeed, and it should redouble our efforts, not just to empathize with and lobby for the cases of people like Jimmy Lai who are imprisoned abroad unjustly, but also for those people like the guy whose name I'm forgetting, but whose video testimonies would led us to find out about human rights abuses with Uyghurs who were about ready to send back to China. Because we no longer accept refugees in this country unless they come from white South Africa. This is terrible. This is our natural, should be the natural core of new Americans are people who stand up to authoritarian countries abroad. And we are closing that door with a clang these days.
So I am pretty sure that I read a report just a couple of hours ago that said that the Trump administration had raised his case this year with the Chinese government, but has unfortunately backed off as part of whatever the Trump administration's current position is with China in terms of the trade war that either is or isn't happening. And in fact, that's what I want to ask you about, Catherine, is what does this sort of thing tell us about American-Chinese relations? I mean, like Matt said, this is a country that suppresses free speech and political dissent, that jails people who say stuff the government doesn't like. Should we really be so fond of open and free trade with this country, which props up their economy?
I remain fond of open and free trade, even with countries that have authoritarian tendencies, not least much more than tendencies in China's case. Because even though I think skeptics of free markets and sort of a global open trade regime often point to China and they say, like, listen, China became a market economy in a very meaningful sense, and that did not bring with it the amount of political liberalism that you libertarians said it would. And that is fair. That is a question worth raising and worth scrutinizing. But we simply do not help the Jimmy Lies of the world. We do not help the Uyghurs of the world even by being more closed to China or to other countries that might follow in China's footsteps. There are people who are, you know, who are suppressed or who are persecuted are always going to be better off if there are simply more paths in and out of every nation, whether that is goods, whether that is humans. And the United States can go a really long way, as Matt said, in opening our doors to people who are, you know, who are not welcome or who are struggling in their home countries, but also opening our markets. I simply don't think it is true that if we made every single chip here at home and we made every single, you know, plastic trinket here at home, that China and the citizens of China and the people of Hong Kong would end up being politically freer as a result.
Liz, I just want to close by asking you sort of about the kind of the contrast between this sort of thing that you see in China and how free speech works in the United States, because it kind of puts to me, I read these, you know, a story about Jimmy Lai being arrested, you know, being jailed, right, being found guilty of all of this stuff repeatedly, right, the kind of political persecution here. And it just puts some of the arguments about authoritarianism and fascism here in the United States in perspective. And Trump is truly awful. Just an unpleasant person on so many levels. And I think not just not a libertarian, but not really fundamentally a liberal in a lot of ways. And yet we sit here for an hour every week and we just bitch about the government. And none of us are afraid that we're going to go to jail because we do so. And that's not the case elsewhere. And I think we take it for granted. Even when you try not to take it for granted, you take it for granted. It's so built into our system.
Yeah, when I was like 13, I went to this private all-girls middle school. And I remember one time we took a field trip to Boston and we stayed overnight. And so naturally the chaperones and the teachers and stuff were like very, very clear with all the girls. Like, hey, I don't want any sneaking out of the rooms. We're going to put tape over the door. That way, you know, if you do break the seal, we'll know and you'll get in trouble in the morning. This is totally, completely permissible for a private school to do to 13-year-old girls with the consent of their parents. But mind you, this is also what the Chinese government did to people, to their citizens, for all of COVID, pretty much. I mean, the Chinese government has a truly perverse relationship to its people. This is a government that has historically starved millions and millions, that forced sterilization and abortion and infanticide, that tried to control the size of people's families and in many cases succeeded, that has tried time and time again to tell people what they can do and where they can live and who they can interact with and what they can believe. And that even to this day, not only interns a bunch of ethnic minorities all over the country, but also puts CCP officials into private companies to ensure that there's no subversion of the government. I mean, truly, every single thing that you do and say is monitored by the Chinese Communist Party. And it is just shocking to me that we've had, you know, five plus years in the United States of checking our privilege, discussing our privilege, talking about our privilege. And we don't really do a very good job, I think, of checking the great liberal democracy privilege that is sort of at the heart of all of these things, that enables all of this discourse, that allows us to have podcasts like this one. And I just think it's really important that we don't take these things lightly, that we don't do stupid virtue signal-y constant freakouts over what the Trump administration does. I think it's really a huge problem that we've lost such a sense of perspective. And over the weekend, I kind of flipped out at some of my neighbors because they're doing a honk protest of Trump on the corner of two streets in Brooklyn, right at the playground. And it's just so damn annoying. But the thing that's perhaps most annoying about it—
Do they have bells? Do they like beat like little drums like my neighbors do?
They have signs, and it's honk if you want to get the stupid, evil fascist out of office. And I'm like, okay, like the honking is legitimately very, very, very annoying if you're over at the playground trying to let children play. But there's also something deeper there, which is like, first of all, I'm glad that you have the right to do this, I guess. But also, this is just classic, like, ultra-progressive hyperbole. Like, no, he's not a fascist authoritarian. And I think, in fact, it's really frustrating that people have just kind of blown all their energy on the stupid protests and the constant freakouts, as opposed to actually sort of reserving some of it for when he does a really egregious thing, or when, God forbid, he seeks, like, a third term. Those are sort of the things that I actually want to freak out about. And it's very, very frustrating to me that the one privilege that we have forgotten to check is the liberal democracy privilege, which people in China do not have.
Yeah, and it really does put things in perspective. Although Trump is kind of an authoritarian. He's got an authoritarian mindset. He just doesn't. But we are lucky that he does not exist in the context of an actually authoritarian system, which makes it harder for him to pursue those authoritarian impulses that I think he often has. It is, in fact, a privilege to live in the United States. We do it wrong. We do it wrong in a lot of ways, but we do it less wrong than everybody else, as particularly where free speech is concerned, which brings us to our final segment, what you've been watching and consuming. We're going to talk about cultural recommendations here. Matt Welch, Rob Reiner and his wife appear to have been murdered over the weekend, and I think you wanted to talk about Rob Reiner and some of his movies just a little bit. I'm sorry for such a bummer news day, guys. This is rough.
Rob Reiner, horrible murder, also a horrible tweet from the president, or Truth Social from the president, truly vile, just kind of unspeakably awful. Rob Reiner, I had recently watched Stand By Me. This is part of his run. His first film was This is Spinal Tap in 1984, which has just changed the trajectory of comedy and rock music forever. It's amazing. But that kicked off like a 10-year run of pretty unimpeachable, just like first 10 years in Hollywood, really fantastic commercial popular work. And Stand By Me, which came out in 86, the summer I turned 18, I recently watched it with my 10-year-old. So it's about a bunch of like 12-year-old-ish boys who are based in like around 1960 in small town Oregon. And they go to try to find a dead body that they've heard about down the railroad tracks. Coming of age story, a lot of nostalgia, but also the kind that's points out that it wasn't all that great necessarily back then, too. It's an adaptation of a Stephen King short story or novella called The Body, which is also great. Rob Reiner was the best at translating Stephen King to the cinema. The name of his company was Castle Rock, which is the fictitious place that shows up in Stephen King's works over and over again. And I hadn't seen this movie in 39 years since it came out. And I remembered loving it at the time. It was a huge Stephen King fan too. And man, does it hold up. It's really, really great. Fun to watch with a 10-year-old. The choice of music is terrific. A bunch of wonderful young actor performances, especially River Phoenix. It's also just sort of interesting to look at the way nostalgia is used at the time and then how we can look back at the movie itself in nostalgic terms, and complete with like the Richard Dreyfuss main character as himself kind of looking back, which is very funny if you consider American Graffiti as well, which is one of the most nostalgic movies of all time. But anyways, it really, really holds up. Really great. Rob Reiner was a that hot streak at the beginning of his career is as good as it gets. Just a terrific kind of humane comedic talent and touch and rom-com touch as well. And I recommend starting with Spinal Tap, of course, if you haven't seen it anytime recently, but Stand By Me is still holding up too.
His recent work in The Bear, just as an actor, is really delightful. His cameo role in the fourth season. But yeah, that period where he was working as a sort of mainstream director, you've got The Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, Misery, and A Few Good Men in the space of about 5 years. That is one of the best runs of a kind of popular commercial director that you can think of, kind of huge range there. The Princess Bride is one of the movies I quote the most often. And When Harry Met Sally is the best romantic comedy ever. It's the only one you ever need. Every other romantic comedy after When Harry Met Sally just wants to be what Harry Met Sally was, because it's unimprovable. Like, if you want to watch a romantic comedy, you should probably just watch that one again, Catherine.
Rude.
Yeah. Do you have a cultural recommendation for us?
I do. So we talked on this podcast previously about Robert Jackson Bennett's first book, The Tainted Cup, in the Shadow of the Leviathan series. I read the second one, too. I'm almost done. Didn't quite finish it in time for the pod, but I read enough to be confident that I recommend it. A Drop of Corruption. It is another.
OK, no spoilers for this now for me, because I'm halfway through that.
No spoilers. It is another Anna and Din mystery, and it is Lovecraftian Sherlock Holmes and Watson, and maybe they meet their Moriarty in this one, which is delightful. There's a locked room mystery. I'm not giving away anything that's not in the very beginning, in a twist that feels pretty relevant to today's pod, I'm realizing. The action is driven in part by a deal made 100 years ago to hand off a previously independent municipality into the hands of that, by the way, is a center of tech and commerce, and to hand off this previously independent municipality to a large, corrupt empire of dubious morals and motivations. So if that resonates with anything for you, maybe this would be a good way to explore those themes in novel form. Just a delight, a good read, recommend it.
Yeah, so I also strongly recommend that, but I watched a different murder mystery, the newest Knives Out film, Wake Up Dead Man. This is Rian Johnson's latest detective film starring Clive Owen. What's his name? The guy for the James Bond, starring
Foghorn,
James Bond.
Leghorn, yes.
Starring Foghorn Leghorn. I've just completely blown his name in my mind. It's gone forever. Starring James Bond.
Daniel Craig.
As the Southern accented detective, except this time it's not really a Benoit Blanc mystery. I mean, it is. He shows up, but he doesn't show up till 45 minutes into the movie, because this is actually a Father Judd mystery. This is a movie that is set inside a small Catholic church in New York, and the pastor, who is kind of Trump-like, is murdered, and then you got to figure out exactly what happened, why, and how, and all of this. And it is It's the best of the Knives Out movies. And the reason that it is the best of the Knives Out movies is that, like the previous two, yes, it is quite political. There is no question where Johnson sort of stands on the kind of left-wing, right-wing scale, right? Like spectrum. You have a kind of annoying MAGA influencer type who is one of the main characters here, who's just constantly spouting kind of annoying right-wing internet meme-y crap, right? And like, it's sometimes it's actually kind of funny, but there's no question where that, like, this is a movie made by someone who is a left winger, who doesn't like Trump, who doesn't like what Trump is doing to American culture. And yet the previous two films were like that, but they were just like that. They were just smug and self-satisfied and happy to be like that and nothing else. And this movie offers a counterbalance in the form of Father Judd, who is the Catholic priest who has been moved into this parish and finds himself in the middle of this murder mystery. And Johnson does something really remarkable in this film, which is that he kind of sets up a dramatic structure that allows himself to argue with his own sensibility, to kind of critique his own smugness and to say there has to be something more in life. There has to be something good that is beyond just being sort of smug and annoying and secular about politics. And so this movie takes the form of a kind of argument with himself about what is good and real in the world. And then it also turns out to be a really tight, really nicely shot, really just satisfying. Starts with a locked room murder mystery, a completely impossible murder that has to be solved. And then, of course, quite complicated machinations out from there. So even if you felt that the first couple of Knives Out films starring James Bond, whatever his name is, were like too annoying for you, I would recommend this one. It's not like suddenly a conservative or a libertarian movie or anything like that. And it doesn't drop politics entirely. But it does this thing that actually brought to mind that line from Tom Stoppard, where he talked about how he writes dialogue and he writes drama because it allows him to contradict himself. And this is a movie in which Johnson actually kind of contradicts himself, argues with himself in the text of the film in a way that I think just makes it much, much more pleasant to watch and much less sort of gratingly smug. So that is Wake Up Dead Man, A Knives Out Mystery. It's on Netflix as of last weekend. Liz Wolf.
I am consuming the historical drama The Chosen, which is about the story of Jesus, the reason for the season.
Nice.
It seems our viewers don't mind terribly when I get a little Bible-y. I have to say, I highly recommend it if you are already Christian. If you are not, in fact, Christian, then you might find it to be the tiniest bit corny with some bad costuming and sometimes some very bad acting. However, I personally enjoy the fact that it goes through the Gospels. It goes through a lot of the miracles sort of early in Jesus's ministry. It's created by Dallas Jenkins, who's super evangelical and Protestant-y and a little cringe, in my opinion. But Jesus is played by Jonathan Rumi, who is a Catholic. So there's a little bit of Catholicism thrown in there. It ends up being a pretty ecumenical offering, in my opinion. And it's also really interesting because the first season is sort of known as the most successful crowdfunded TV series in basically all of history so far, where, you know, millions and millions of people, I believe, contributed to it to sort of get it the funding that it needed to get off the ground. And then it actually became a really successful show and later on was picked up by Amazon Studios. So I think it's kind of an interesting business story, like business entertainment story, even if you're not interested in the actual historical drama of Jesus, which I think you should be. But in part just because it's interesting just how many people all around the world were sort of clamoring for somebody to go through the Bible and actually find a way of transmitting this fascinating story to the screen. And it's really difficult because they, you know, have to take certain creative liberties. They have to figure out which interpretations they use and how they're going to most effectively tell the Jesus story while also not engaging in any awful acts of sacrilege. But it's made all the better by the fact that, honestly, the apostles are super handsome. And I think that the show does a really good job of portraying how Jesus is persecuted by the Romans and the Pharisees and sort of all the political influences that he comes under and that are very threatened by him. And it reminds me of something that Peter Suderman will, in fact, appreciate. The immortal words of the rappers Run the Jewels. Never forget, in the story of Jesus, the hero was killed by the state.
Love that band. Love that album. When's Run the Jewels 5 coming out? Anybody know? It's gotta be soon. I know Killer Mike's doing his own
rap
stuff.
Music now that I have kids.
You're missing out. You know, if you think about it, Christianity also sort of crowdfunded.
Wow.
For 2,000 years. All right, folks, that is our show. As always, if you like this podcast, you can support us by going to reason.com/donate. That is reason.com/donate. Thank you all so much for listening. The Reason Roundtable will return.